Hey everybody, it's Patrick from F This Movie. I apologize for the way I sound. I have a pretty bad cold right now. I'm super excited about this week's show. Scary Movie Month is coming up in just under a week, and to get you guys all ready and to sort of kick things off, we have such a cool show this week. Thanks to my friend Heather Wixon, otherwise known as The Horror Chick, who you should all be following on Twitter. She's at The Horror Chick. She helped coordinate an interview with the one and only Tom Holland, the director of Child's Play and Fright Night. He wrote Psycho 2. He wrote Cloak and Dagger. He has an amazing career. He was such a great guy to talk to. Super just nice to me. Had so much to say about his career, his movies, his approach to storytelling. I just think there's a ton of information to be taken away from this interview. And he talked to me for over an hour. He was just so accommodating and cool. So I really hope you guys like it. Tom Holland is a great filmmaker and certainly one of my favorites. So I hope you guys enjoy this interview.
You were about to ask me how I got into this, right?
Well, yeah, sort of. I was going to start with Psycho 2 because I know you had written The Beast Within was really your only produced screenplay when you got the job for Psycho 2, right?
Well, I had also written a movie of the week called Initiation of Sarah.
Oh, okay.
Which at the time was a big deal, not because it was horror. It was ABC, and it was they sort of took all the horror out that I wrote. But they took the female star and they tossed it. It was a college sorority movie, and they took the female star and they tossed her in the fountain, and she came out with a wet T-shirt, and you could see her hard nipples, and it created a scandal in 1977. IMDb.
I got it.
Yeah. I'll tell you the star was in a second. Blonde.
Okay.
I can't remember now. Very hot number in 1977. Okay. Initiation of Sarah. Morgan Fairchild.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah. And they remade that about 2 years ago. I think Disney or Sony remade it. And Morgan Fairchild played like the sorority mother or something. That was the first one, and that was a TV show, and then 1980, The Beast Within was the first movie. Yes,
that's okay.
The first success was Psycho 2.
And how did you end up being hired to write Psycho 2? Did you have to go in and make a pitch for that?
Actually, I submitted scripts that I'd written, spec scripts.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Franklin, the director, really liked the material, my material. And I was called into Universal, and I had a meeting with him, and we just got along. I mean, I was walking around in those days, and I was dumb and blind and didn't know how anything happened. And I got hired for the job, but it was not a big deal. That was 1982, and cable had just begun. And originally, Psycho 2 was a cable movie for a new cable company out of San Diego called Oak Communication. And Richard said to me, "Well, they think this is like a throwaway, but the way that we can make something out of this." Is that you have to come up with a part that's good enough to seduce Tony Perkins back into playing Norman Bates.
Right.
And if we get Tony playing Norman again, maybe we can get the studio to release it as a theatrical. So I got hired to do a cable movie. And then dreams come true. The script turned out pretty well. Actually, I'm terribly proud of that movie because I worked on it so hard. But anyway, Tony did say yes, and Universal still didn't know what they were going to do with it. And then they put out a press release saying Tony Perkins was going to reprise Norman Bates in Psycho 2, and there was this enormous worldwide media reaction, and Universal was almost forced into releasing it as a theatrical. So they were led kicking and screaming into releasing the movie, and we did it the same way Hitchcock had done the original, which is to say we shot it like it was a TV movie, and we did it. Everything was on the back lot at Universal except for one shot, which was in the cemetery, and that was the biggest grossing movie of the summer of 1982.
It's a terrific movie. Was there any concern at the time that if the movie wasn't a success, do you feel like that might have been the end of your screenwriting career? Because obviously, I'm sure there was a lot of skepticism when Universal announces they're going to do a Psycho 2. It's not necessarily the kind of thing that everybody thought was a logical choice for a sequel. So if the movie comes out and it doesn't do well, what do you think is the impact on your screenwriting career?
I don't think you would have ever heard of me again.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And also, they didn't do sequels in those days. I mean, it was really like it was bargain bin. It was a toss away.
Yeah.
And it was just that once again, a major corporation had no idea of the value of their catalog. I mean, now they do because we're living in a time of sequels and, you know, and remakes and all of that.
Yeah.
Now they're constantly plundering and pirating. But in those days, believe it or not, they did originals. And to even make it seem more odd, in those days, I think if you were to look, you'd find that there was more R ratings than there were PG.
Yeah, I miss those days.
It was the aftermath of the creativity of the 70s was still chugging along all the way into well into the 80s. And then it just all got wiped out in the 90s.
Yeah. The thing that I like so much about Psycho 2 is that for all of the, you know, it certainly pays tribute to the original film in a lot of its plotting and in the way that it has some twists and surprises. But that it really is a really, really great character piece, that it sort of takes a look at here's where Norman Bates is 20 years later. How much of that for you was sort of a balancing act between, okay, I want to really write about this character and what has happened to him, but also I need to deliver those kinds of thriller elements?
Well, the all of that, that's 10 questions in one question. I had to seduce Tony to have a theatrical because we didn't have one going in. And, you know, what everybody loved and what I loved about Psycho, the original, which I think is the greatest horror film of my life, it redefined horror.
Yeah.
And we're still living with Hitchcock's definition of horror today. The what made Norman Bates so fascinating as portrayed by Tony Perkins is he was the serial murderer you felt sorry for and involved with and wanted to protect.
Yeah.
I mean, that he's the sympathetic serial murderer. And I don't really, I got to know Tony, but, you know, I don't know whether, I would think that was Tony more than that was Hitchcock, but I don't know how much was in Joe Stefano's script either. It's very interesting because I'm being bitchy, and I don't mean to be, but if you look at that, at the remake that they did, where they reshot it, you know, it's a huge miss. I mean, you know, you don't feel any of the things that you felt in the original, and yet it's an exact duplication of the script, and it's shot for shot.
Yeah.
And the actors in the remake, they're all very good and very talented. Vince Vaughn does not engender any of the sympathy that Tony Perkins did.
Yeah.
So Tony Perkins was absolutely brilliant, and without Tony, you never would have had a movie. Now, of course, then you went on and had sequels, and I think the last one Tony wasn't in, and then now they're in their second iteration of Bates Motel, and of course, obviously, Tony isn't in it. But that Norman Bates, Tony's interpretation of Norman Bates was so burned into my generation's consciousness because it had been such a, it was the beginning of the modern horror movie that for my generation anyway, Psycho without Tony Perkins was unthinkable. And Tony was some kind of genius, you know? So anyway, I perfectly well knew what I was doing. What I did with Psycho 2 was I took that sympathetic side of Tony. It's the side where, you know, he's killing, but he doesn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
It's not his fault. It's because of this horrendous childhood. You know, I mean, to some extent, I did that too previously with The Beast Within, but it got muted for a lot of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But it came through loud and clear in Psycho 2. And so I worked very, very hard at that screenplay because I went into that assuming that I was going to be critically killed for even having dared to do a sequel to what at that point was acknowledged as the great horror film of my generation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so you knew that you were going to get killed. And I will add, because I researched the original before I wrote the sequel, that the original Psycho had gotten some of the worst and most vituperative reviews that I have ever read. I mean, the critical reaction to the original, to Hitchcock's original Psycho, were filled with hate and such a negative reaction to the visceral violence and to the feelings of terror that it engendered. It was considered savage and beyond the pale of good taste. And I know from talking to the people involved that Mr. Hitchcock, which is what they called him on the Universal lot,
I was
still working on that sequel with a lot of the people who had known Mr. Hitchcock and worked with him. In fact, our producer, Hilton Green, was the AD, the assistant director, to Hitch on the original Psycho, that Hitchcock was so upset and so disturbed in the first few days after they released the movie when he saw the reviews that he thought of withdrawing it from theatrical distribution. And then he went around and looked at the theaters and the lines are around the block. And at that point he knew that he had a hit regardless of what the reviews were, but the reviews scared the hell out of him.
Right.
And you know, on Psycho 2, actually, contrary to my greatest fears, the reviews were very, very kind on Psycho 2. But what I did was remain as faithful as I could to the given circumstances of the original. And as far as I know, there's nothing in Psycho 2 that doesn't stand on the original.
And how do you manage to crack? Because obviously there's a challenge in trying to, you know, because the original has sort of one of the great, a couple of really the great twists of all time. And so you want to try and work some of that into the sequel, but, you know, you have an audience that's coming in maybe expecting some of that. So how do you manage to break? I don't necessarily want to give away what the twist is in case there's anybody listening who hasn't seen it, but everybody should see Psycho 2. But how do you sort of break this idea of how you are going to twist the mythology? I mean, the reveal at the end is kind of, it's on par with the twist in the original.
Thank you. Well, you somewhere in one of your first questions, you talked about character.
Yes.
And Psycho 2 comes out of character. The premise is character-based. Norman Bates is released from the institution after being in there 22 years. And the psychiatrist says that he's sane at last. And what makes Norman so sympathetic is this is a man who's not particularly well-balanced, who's desperately trying to hold on to his sanity as the relatives of his dead victims, Norma Crane and Marion Crane, are torturing him and trying to make him go crazy again. And so you're with Norman, your sympathy's with Norman, because you know he's slowly losing it and becoming more and more dangerous, and Tony had this vulnerability that made you feel sorry for him and made you care about him. So you care about, you're in this weird position, which Hitchcock really used too. You know, this voyeurism. You're watching a man with a delicate grip on sanity slowly being driven insane, and part of you saying, "Oh no, Norman, please don't lose your mind." And the other part of you is saying, "Lose it, Norman. Those people who are torturing you." I came up with a twist at the end, which is, well, I don't think it's anywhere near as good as was what the original Psycho was, but it's very, very satisfying when you reveal who Mother is.
Right. Well, then that's what I like about it, is that it's not just a twist that's sort of randomly introduced, that it's a twist on the established sort of mythology.
And it got in the mythology because I was so terrified of being savaged by the critics, but also it comes out of character, because I had to write a strong character piece to get Tony Perkins to come back and do it again.
Right, right. Have you watched Bates Motel at all?
I plead guilty. No, I haven't, but I've met the showrunner. I can't remember his name now, but I understand the show is very good. I think the guy came out of Lost. And if you want a piece of Arcana, is that how it's pronounced?
I believe so, yeah.
The guy who's producing and showrunning the Bates Motel was Bernie Schwartz's assistant, and Bernie Schwartz was the producer of Psycho 2.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I was at a Masters of Horror dinner, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 months ago, and the fellow's name I can't remember right now came up and introduced himself and told me that I had known him since then. Of course, I had no memory.
Carlton Cuse, is that who you're
talking about? That's right. Yeah. Carlton what?
Cuse, yeah.
Yes, that's exactly it. Yes, Carlton.
I had just watched the whole series because it just came out on DVD and Blu-ray. I didn't watch it when it was on, but I just watched it, and it's fine. I'm not going to talk smack about the show, but one of the things that I thought was so interesting, and I think this can be pulled into some of your work, is that it really seems like they're trying to walk this line between paying service to the original stuff and trying to create their own identity, but in doing so, and I guess, all right, I'm going to talk a little bit of smack about the show. I feel like they don't always understand what it is that made the original special. And where this, for me, ties in with your career is a couple years ago, and I don't want you to necessarily have to talk bad about the remake of Fright Night, but I saw the remake of Fright Night when it came out a couple years ago, and I felt like no one involved with that movie, while they all gave it their all, understood what made the original movie special. And I wonder, you know, we're finally sort of on the other side of this remake culture. I think things are still being remade, but it seems like there's more original stuff finally coming out. But I feel like in so many instances, when these remakes were coming out, that it was just about brand recognition and not really trying to understand why we love the original thing. And that's, and to take it back to Psycho 2, that's so much of why that movie works. Like I said, that it understands why we love Psycho, but it also creates its own identity.
Thank you. I mean, yes, I can't agree more, but you see, there was no competitiveness on my part, or Richard Franklin, the director, nor jealousy. Because A, Mr. Hitchcock was dead, and B, he was such a towering genius, and we stood in such awe of his accomplishments that we were fans. We didn't have the hubris to think that in any way we were competing.
Sure.
All we were doing was, you know, was praising. You know, that was we Psycho 2 was a love letter to Psycho, to the original. You know, now you know what happens when you get remakes, let's say, and once again, I don't mean to bitch any of the people who remade Fright Night, but one of the things that happens, because I've been there, when you remake something is you say, well, I'm going to do it better, or I'm going to stamp it with my unique interpretation or whatever, and they either didn't understand what made it unique in the first place, or it's the old saying, every dog has to piss on it to make it their own. You know, there are a lot of things that go on, and none of those things went on with Psycho 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess maybe we should jump into Fright Night, because, and again, I could do a whole show on my problems with the remake, but there's this idea that with a lot of the remakes, it seems like studios or whoever it is that's putting these things out sort of has this attitude that, well, no one will go back and watch a movie from 1985. It's too dated, or they can't understand the references or whatever. But one of the things that I like about Fright Night, and Heather should definitely jump in here because I know it's her favorite movie ever. One of the things I like about Fright Night so much is that it's completely timeless. That movie, it pays respect to the 30s and 40s. It's very much within the 80s, but I think you can watch it today, and it 100% holds up because of how classical it is, because of how seriously it takes sort of the mythology of monsters. And I understand, you know, when they made the remake, there's not necessarily such a thing as horror TV shows anymore in terms of the kind of show that Peter Vincent hosted. I know Elvira is still in syndication, but that sort of thing isn't as popular as it once was. But again, I don't want to just rip on it, but making him a Vegas musician or magician, I didn't feel like was a worthy substitute. But, you know, how much of that was in your mind when writing Fright Night in terms of writing a movie that works in any decade?
Well, Fright Night, thank you very much for the compliments. The Fright Night is my experience as a mad movie fan, as an adolescent, and as a teen. And, you know, for me, they were the AIP Hammer films.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of love. It's a warm, funny, affectionate picture, a movie about gonzo horror fans. And I think that those of us who experienced that in our younger years, that although the genre may mutate, the affection and the fascination and the sense of wonder that made us, and fun that made us horror movie fans, goes the character, the emotions go down through the generations, even if the genre, you know, changes and mutates. And I think that's why the picture continues to have a calling. I mean, we've all felt like Evil Ed, you know?
Right.
We've all felt like the odd man out in high school because we were in love with whatever horror movie that was current at the time. And so I think the sense of alienation and being different and the premise is conceptually it's humorous that the kid next door, the horror maniac fan next door becomes convinced that his next door neighbor is a vampire. There's something very funny about that, but I tell you, I'd watch that movie now. You know what I mean? Because there's something that's very juicy and enjoyable about it.
Yeah.
And I think it echoes for all of us, you know, that love the genre. And so, to be flat out, look, the remake was technically on every level very, very good. The actors, the writing, the direction, the effects and everything else. But there is no humor, there's no warmth, and there's no heart to it. There's no love of the genre to it.
Yes.
And so you're looking at something that is technically very adroit, but it doesn't have a beating heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I especially felt bad for Colin Farrell, who I think is a terrific actor, and they absolutely killed Jerry Dandridge. They gave Jerry Dandridge, that poor guy, he had nothing to play as an actor.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I thought, you know, the idea of setting it, I guess, in Vegas was sort of clever in terms of, well, the city never sleeps, but even structurally, they made a lot of weird choices. But again, I don't want you to have to...
I'll do a very quick strike. Structurally, there were some disastrous choices.
Yes.
First, Charlie is the motor that makes it go, but in the original, Charlie is the one who sees Jerry Dandridge carrying the coffin into the basement of the house next door. So Charlie is the one who's motivated to try to find out what's going on.
Right.
In the remake, it happens off screen, and it's Evil Ed. So you've already made a shift in focus that absolutely cripples the motivation of your lead. You've already lost what made the original so strong, because you've lost, excuse me, there's nothing original under the sun, but you've lost the boy who cried wolf quality.
Right.
What makes it funny and so involving is it's a horror movie fan, which is all of us, who is saying, well, there's a vampire next door, and because he's such a gonzo horror movie fan, no one believes him. In the remake, by giving it to Evil Ed, you've totally taken that away. Now you've made Charlie one of the doubters.
Right.
Who has to be convinced.
Right.
So you've lost the audience identification with Charlie as the horror movie fan, which is what we all are.
It felt so much like they tried to reverse engineer the screenplay to find a way to give context to that "you're so cool, Brewster," that was the line that stuck out, and then they reverse engineered the whole script that way. But let me ask you this about Fright Night, because one of the things that I love about Fright Night, which, again, I'm not trying to embarrass Heather, but I know she's a huge fan too. It's one of my favorite horror movies of all time. One of the things that I love about it that you don't really see, I don't feel like, in horror movies now, is that the teenage characters in that movie feel like real teenagers. They even look like real teenagers. And so many horror movies now that come out, you know, it's all sort of beautiful people from the WB or whatever, that it's this sort of... they're almost grown in a laboratory as opposed to feeling like actual people. And was any of that, were you conscious of any of that when casting the movie or writing those parts?
I was conscious of the fact that even then they were consistently casting people in their late 20s,
right,
to play teenagers. And I did my best to get people who were close to the high school age, even though I think that they were all like early 20s. I mean, Evil Ed might have been around 20. They were all like 20, 21, 22.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a big difference as opposed to 26, 27, 28. And I had 2 weeks of rehearsals with the actors, which I've never had in any film since. And we were able to work on character. And I think that's one of the reasons that the characters feel as well developed as they are, and the actors mesh as well as they do. And a tip of the hat to Roddy McDowall, who sort of became like the den father. You know, I mean, you know, as we went through the experience, it melded into a little company. you know, a little touring company of very, very young, comparatively inexperienced actors, mm-hmm. except for Roddy, of course, and Chris, Chris Sarandon, who had already been nominated for an Academy Award. I mean, it was really a terrific cast of people. They did a wonderful job. And, you know, and it was character driven again. It didn't have the psychological depth that Psycho 2 did, but it had an honesty and it had an affection. You have to remember that, I mean, less so now in a way, but back then, horror was really the lowbrow genre. Everybody looked down on it. It was the exploitation genre. You got no credit for doing a successful horror movie. I had somebody big in the Academy tell me that they wouldn't let me in the Academy on Fright Night because it was a horror movie and it was not respectable. And that was the attitude in 1984-85. And I think maybe now it's changed a bit, but I bet it hasn't changed that much. I mean, you know, you have this very weird and yet wonderful thing going on where right now horror movies are probably the hottest financial, you know, the returning, certainly percentage-wise, the most remunerative genre in the business. So I think it at least gets more commercial respect now. Mm-hmm. But back then, I mean, you know, you were tarred and feathered, and I know a lot of people have affection for it. But you know, with the Friday the 13th, it was considered a day class A derivative genre, and you know, it was either where you began and got out of as quickly as possible, or you touched base there on the way down.
Right.
It got no respect.
Well, and that's one of the things that I love so much about horror movies, particularly in the 80s, is that there is sort of something for everyone, you know, depending on what kind of horror movie you like. There's sort of the slasher, you know, Friday the 13th type. There's crazy Italian movies being made. And then there's really kind of fun, character-driven stuff, like Fright Night. And how did you end up sort of directing that movie? Was that where you came with the script and said, if you want to make this, I'm directing, or...
Yes, I did, but I was also one of the hottest writers in town.
Right.
Because I'd done Cloak and Dagger, I'd done the Psycho 2, I can't remember, Class of 84. Mm-hmm. I mean, what had started to happen was my movies were consistently making money, and in some cases a lot of money. And that was the moment in time that the studios would have a slate of, how, I don't know, 12, 20, 18 movies per studio per year, and Fright Night was the throwaway movie. They would always have one sort of exploitation movie in there that they did very cheaply, and if it went bad, it didn't hurt the, you know, the overall slate. And they didn't pay Columbia. They didn't pay any attention to me in the movie because they all thought that their biggest commercial movie of the year was going to be a little number called Perfect. Do you remember it at all?
Sure, the Rolling Stone aerobics movie.
That's right, and that had the hottest stars, the hottest director. I think they had the guy that now his name's out of my head, but who shot the Godfather movies. You know, was shoot. So everybody was paying attention to that, and nobody paid any attention to me in Fright Night. And for the first and only time in my life, I was left totally alone. Now historically, at the same time that I was doing that, that was the beginning of the last gasp of the classical studio system, because the major corporations at that moment had started to buy out Hollywood. And Columbia was bought at that moment by Coca-Cola, by the first major corporation. And so that was the beginning of also the MBAs moving in and taking control in Hollywood.
Yeah.
The head of the studio at that moment in time was a wonderful man called Guy McElwain, who was an agent, who'd become an agent and become head of the studio because he was such a terrific, terrific agent. But that was still, Guy McElwain in that year still controlled the slate at of movies that were made. There was no corporate board. There was no large corporation. It was him and Ray Stark that still had control of what Columbia was doing. And two or three years later, you know, it wasn't Coca-Cola, but Coca-Cola sold it. Then I forget what happened. Sony bought it, and, you know, Columbia was merged, the Sony. But there was that moment in time when you still had these buccaneers and gunslingers who were making decisions in town, and it wasn't by committee yet. By the 90s, it was by committee.
Yeah.
I was lucky. I was dumb lucky.
How do you end up – so when you start on that movie as director, I mean, because you had been in the business for such a long time, because you had worked in different – you know, you'd been in front of the camera, you'd been a writer, so you'd been on sets for so long. Did you feel, you know, totally confident when you start directing them? It's a very – I feel like especially for a first movie as a director, obviously it's not your first, you know, job on a movie, but your first time directing, it's a really confidently made movie. And is that just – would you attribute that to just having been on sets for so long?
No, I've got – yes, I mean, undoubtedly that helped. But I was really lucky. I had the support, and now his name is out of my head, but the head of production at Columbia at that moment, and maybe I'll think of him. I don't think he's credited on the movie, but he surrounded me with the top craftsmen in Hollywood. What happened was they had just finished Ghostbusters, and they had made every mistake that you could possibly make with effects. And they learned by doing that, and that was Richard Edlund that had done Ghostbusters. And I inherited so many of the production people from Ghostbusters, this massive, hugely expensive movie, and they brought all their knowledge over to Fright Night. And it one of the reasons is because I was so well supported, and that was because of the line producer Jerry Berowitz, and because of the guy that hired Jerry Berowitz, who was head of production at the studio. And I just can't remember his name, and maybe I will. But you know, I just don't know. He was head of Columbia at that moment. I'll think of it. He's passed now. But what I'm trying to say is that I had a huge amount of production support from the studio, from Columbia. And so I'm very, very thankful to that and those people. And Richard Edlund was extreme, that was Ghostbusters, that was, Jesus, Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Jerry Berowitz that you were
thinking of? No, I can't remember his name now. Before we're through, maybe I will. I just had top flight people that were coming off of the Harrison Ford movie where he was the archaeologist. Give me the name.
Indiana Jones.
Yeah, Indiana Jones.
Mm-hmm.
I had all these people on the effects side who worked on all these huge movies, and so they didn't let me go wrong. And I had these young guys beginning out too. I had Steve Johnson, you know, doing makeup and sculpturing, and Randy Cook. Randy Cook went on for Lord of the Rings to win the Academy Award. You know, so I mean, I had the best of the older people and the best of the young up and comers working on this little horror film, and it was Shel Schrager. Was the name of the head of production at Columbia at that moment, and he put together the team that supported me, and I never would have been able to choose the quality of people that Shell put together.
Mm-hmm.
So I just had a, and I don't think it would have happened if they hadn't just finished Ghostbusters.
Right.
I mean, you know, because right after this tells you how lucky timing is. And you can't do anything about it. But right after that when I was still at Columbia, they moved Guy McElwain out, and they brought in that British producer, whose name I can't remember any longer, who'd done Chariots of Fire. And they brought him in for 5 minutes to head up Columbia.
Is that David Putnam?
Yes.
Yeah.
David Putnam. And David Putnam said, well, I don't want anybody at Columbia who makes tacky little horror films like Fright Night. And he essentially forced me off the lot, took away my overall deal, and took away, you know, what at that moment was like one of the hottest. I was like the hottest genre filmmaker within the studio system at that moment in time, which must have been about 1985. And David Putnam was a total snob.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a horrid, horrid human being. And, you know, and he gets all these accolades for, you know, for doing these prestige movies, which nobody watches anymore.
Yeah, I've seen Fright Night 50 times. I've seen Chariots of Fire 0 times.
There you go. Thank you. But that was the existing attitude towards genre films then. You know, and nobody better personified the snobbishness and the lack of business acumen than David Putnam did. And, of course, he fired everybody at Columbia and then got into it. He mixed it up with Ray Stark, and Ray Stark fired him in turn. I mean, Putnam was gone in a couple of years.
Yeah.
And put together a disastrous slate of commercial movies.
Well, then good riddance.
But if you talk to people, David Putnam is considered one of the shining lights of 1980s creativity out of Britain.
Right. So then how do you end up moving on to doing something like Fatal Beauty from sort of from developing your own movie and writing and directing your own thing, and now you're kind of doing more of, I guess, what would be considered a star vehicle?
Well, I guess you could say it was a mistake, but I think it was... I thought it was a terrific movie. I thought Whoopi was a lot of fun. But I got killed by the critics, and you know, because it was considered a ripoff of the Eddie Murphy movie,
Beverly Hills Cop.
Beverly Hills Cop, which
yeah.
I suppose was true. When I got into it, it was supposed to be a noir thriller with Cher, and Cher was smarter than I was. She bailed out of Fatal Beauty and went and made Moonlighting?
Moonstruck.
And went and made Moonstruck. And I did that because everybody was telling me that I had to get away from genre films. Because if I did another genre film, they said, I would never get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because the genre was considered de classe. And if I wanted to be an A filmmaker, I had to get away from horror. And I think you still see that as the attitude. Ask James Wan as he goes into...
Fast 7.
Yes, he goes into...
Fast and Furious number 7.
But, I mean, if you were to talk to him, I bet there's somebody advising him, he better get away from doing Blumhouse films and get out of the genre.
Yeah.
Because that was certainly all the advice from the business people, the agents and lawyers that surrounded me at the time. But so you'll understand, I feel very good about Fatal Beauty. I feel it's a very good film, even though it's out of the genre, and even though it was savaged by the critics at the time.
No, I actually
it's enjoyable.
Yeah, I really like that movie. I think it's got a really cool kind of.
It's got an energy.
It does. It's got a cool kind of 80s cop movie vibe, and I like that genre, and I think it's one of the better entries in it. And I feel like it still feels like one of your films, even though it's not necessarily, it didn't originate from you necessarily the way Fright Night did, but I feel like I can watch Fatal Beauty and definitely tell that that you made it.
Thank you.
So then you get to Child's Play, and... I had just rewatched Child's Play earlier today, actually, and it, something you had said earlier kind of made me think of Child's Play, because you had said that you wrote Psycho 2 very much as a character movie, and I think that's true of Fright Night as well, that it's, yeah, there's vampires and crazy monsters and stuff, but all of the stuff that's best about that movie, all of the action comes out of the characters. And those are kind of my favorite kinds of movies, the the movie I always point to is Die Hard, which is a great action movie, but it comes all, entirely out of characters. Watching Child's Play again today, that movie, for as much as it could have been, I think, maybe a silly movie. It's this, oh, it's a killer doll. That it's not silly at all, that you take it seriously while still having fun with it, and that it really does come out. It's sort of a character piece between Chris Sarandon and Catherine Hicks and little Andy, and I guess you could also include Charles Lee Ray as part of that, that it's sort of this four-cornered character piece. And was that... I know that the script didn't originate with you, but I know you came on and made some significant changes, including adding the whole Charles Lee Ray element. So do you sort of approach all of your movies that way to try and boil it down to, well, this all needs to come out of the characters?
I try. It doesn't mean that I'm successful.
Sure.
As far as I'm concerned, Child's Play is an original with me. There was an original script before me, but I certainly didn't use anything from it.
Sure.
What happens is, if the director is also writing, the Writers Guild is, the rules are set up, is to make sure that any other writer that has worked on it or made a contribution gets a credit.
Mm-hmm.
If the director is not going for a writing credit, then every writer has to write at least a third to get credit. In order for the director to get credit on a screenplay, he has to write at least 50%, if not more. So, in other words, so if the director gets writing credit, then basically any other writer does. You know, what happened there was that there was an existing screenplay, and I came on that after Fright Night, and I tried to get a screenplay out of it, and then I couldn't solve it.
Mm-hmm.
And in despair, I left it and went and made Fatal Beauty. And then after Fatal Beauty, I came back, and while I had been gone, Joe Rubin had tried to get a script out of Child's Play. And Joe had his writer on it, John LaFia, I believe, and he hadn't been able to get a script out of it, and he bailed. And I came back, and I struggled so much with it. I came back on it, and I took it up again, because what attracted me to it was that there was a premise there that was universal, in the sense that I think all of us, when we were little kids, have looked around our room in the middle of the night when a dark thunderstorm was going on and the lightning was crackling, and have said to ourselves in our deepest fear, oh my goodness, what would happen if my dolls came alive, if my action figures suddenly started to move? There's something that every one of us as kids, we've all thought that or wanted that to happen. And I knew that there was such a common worldwide experience of that I felt that there was something that would appeal worldwide about Child's Play. Now, I gave it the name. The original script was called Blood Buddy, and it didn't have a story, really. It was more of an episode. It was more of a Talking Tina episode of,
Twilight Zone.
Twilight Zone, right.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I had seen in my childhood was a TV movie called Trilogy of Terror.
Yes.
Okay. And you remember the Zuni doll and Karen Black, right?
Of course.
Okay, that's a Richard Matheson short story. And that has to be one of the most terrifying shorts that I have ever seen. And that was in the day before they had Steadicams. And what the director, who was also the producer of Dark Shadows, had done that was so amazing was he'd taken that heavy 35mm camera and he put it on roller skates. And he took it across, from the doll's point of view, about 4 inches, 5 inches above the floor, and he had it chase Karen Black around that apartment. And it was absolutely terrifying. And then whenever he would cut to the doll, He cut to this stupid 6-inch Zumi doll and shake it in print. No? And put that behind it. But it was absolutely terrifying. So I knew going into Child's Play that, because by then we had Steadicams, and you had a low boy Steadicam, which is the way where you fix it so the lens is at knee level. I knew that I could chase my actress and the little boy around the set, and when I turned around the point of view, if I could get some kind of animation out of the plastic doll's face, I knew I had some terrifying set pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So it was attractive to me, both as a premise that everybody thought would understand, but I also knew visually that I could sell the terror of it because of Dan Curtis. It was Dan Curtis who did Trilogy of Terror because of what he did with Zumi Doll.
Mm-hmm.
And so those two things are what drew me to it, but I couldn't figure out how to make the son of a gun work. Because the problem with it is how do you make a doll terrifying? How do you make an audience believe that a doll really comes to life? And then once you do that, how do you get the audience to willingly suspend disbelief? And it was at that moment in time where you started to have computer chips in these dolls. And so you were getting, you never knew what the damn thing was going to say. It wasn't like laying it down and saying it, and it would say, "I want a wee wee," which was what they used to say when I was a kid. With the new computer chips, they could come up with non sequiturs left and right. And that was sort of creepy. And then you also had, at that moment in time, a very popular doll that was life size called My Buddy.
Right.
And I couldn't use Buddy in the title, or when I wrote the script, I originally called him Buddy, but I couldn't use it, and that's how we ended up with Chucky. But we ended up with Chucky because I did Charles Lee Ray, which of course is the three names of three famous psycho killers of that time. What happened was, I still couldn't make the damn. I knew it had to be about a single mother, and I knew it had to be about a little boy who was so young and innocent that he would have the innocence to believe his doll was coming alive. And I knew that it was when I got the idea and I created Charles Lee Ray and I put that serial killer inside that little boy's doll that the movie took on a whole level of terror that I knew felt real to me and that I could sell to an audience, and I knew that their heart would be with the little boy and with the mother, Catherine Hicks, because the danger to the little boy would be so great by putting a monster inside that doll. And when I came up with Charles Lee Ray and was able to put Chucky inside that goddamn doll, that was when I could write the screenplay, because I knew what was going to motivate Charles Lee Ray. He wanted revenge on his partner in crime who left him at the scene at the opening. He wanted to get the cop who had killed him. He wanted revenge on him. And then this was a reach, but by then the audience was going with it. I finally had to come up with some kind of rationale for how a killer could put his soul inside of a plastic, 4-foot doll.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up with voodoo because I was reaching for the stars, and of course that's quite silly. But by that time you were so far into it and involved with Catherine Hicks' situation and the little boy's situation that you accepted it.
Yeah, again, I love, one of my favorite things about the movie is that whole single mom dynamic, because it's sort of like watching Charlie Brewster again, except at a very young age, except now you've given him somebody to team up with, and they're this unit, but even the unit, nobody believes. And, Chris Sarandon is sort of on hand as the skeptic, but I really love that that dynamic of even before Chucky really enters the picture, there's this sense of sort of those two against the world, and your sympathy is with them from the first scene when he's making her breakfast. I mean, you automatically have so much affection and sympathy for those characters that I just think it works like hell. I just think it's really great.
Thank you. That's humanity.
Yeah.
I mean, that there is nothing stronger than a mother's love for her child. And I think we all understand that. And, you know, and at the end you have the promise of a family back together again, you know, with Chris and Catherine and little boy. It was wonderful, by the way. Vincent, you know.
Alex Vincent.
Alex Vincent, yes. I mean, you know, he was just terrific. I found him in a casting call in New York. He's out in New Jersey. I think he'd done a few commercials, and he was the most natural little boy, you know, that you're going to – he wasn't an actor. He was, you know, and he had such sweetness and such vulnerability. He's only like 7 or 8 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so it you know, so it, once again, everything came together, but that script was right. You know, the heart of that script was right. And so because the emotional situation was so strong, you suspended disbelief in an idea that's inherently beyond silly. It's stupid. well, if you go look at any of the other movies where they tried, you know, die, you know, Leprechaun or, you know, I mean, you know, there were a whole bunch of them where they tried to bring, you know, I mean, you know, before Child's Play, the only one that they'd had, I think, was the one with Sean Connery, something in the Irish Leprechauns, Terry McGill, McGillis, the Little People.
Yeah. Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Thank you, Darby McGill. Yeah. Yes, that was it, and that was where I got the idea for the first perspectives I used to try to make the damn thing work, because I had nothing but horrendous problems trying to make the doll believable, because, you know, there was no CGI in those days, and that was all mechanical effects. And trying to animate a doll was extremely difficult, given the limited technical means then at our disposal.
Right. Do they, when the rights sort of switch over to Universal and they decide that they're going to sequelize it like crazy, do they approach you to do the sequels, or are those, and then you turn those down, or is that just done completely without you?
They had to come contractually to me with an offer for the first sequel.
Okay.
I turned it down because I just didn't have any faith in the script.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, because I mean, what you, once again, you know, Hollywood is a town where you scratch everybody's back. So you never say anything bad about anybody else, because you're going to work with them at some point, or they can give you a job or whatever. So I probably shouldn't say that, but you know, I think all the sequels, you can tell that the voice is so different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, none of them have had, you know, the reality or the terror or the feeling that, you know, was there in the original. So I just didn't like the scripts.
Sure.
So, and then of course it went on its own, and they haven't remade it because they split the rights between MGM UA, which was then bought by Sony.
Okay.
And Universal, which bought the sequel rights from MGM, and one of the stupidest deals that MGM ever made. They sold the sequel rights to Universal, and Universal's been doing, you know, direct-to-DVD, direct-to-VOD ever since. And just recently, in the last 3 or 4 months, I think Universal finally bought the remake rights away from Sony MGM UA. So now I'm sure that they'll remake it. But given where Hollywood is now, and I think this was on the most recent sequel, direct to VOD, they'll do wall to wall CGI, I'm sure, because you're still the expense involved with doing in camera effects, in other words, using a real doll, is probably prohibitive today, and you're still never going to get the animation that you can with CGI.
Right.
But the problem there is, and this is an aesthetic argument, is that when you do wall-to-wall CGI, I at least feel like I'm in a video game. In other words, in-camera effects are what I used in the original where there's a doll, where it really is, you know, where it's really being done by puppeteers and by wires and cables off camera. It gives it a reality that you don't get with CGI.
Well, and that's always my issue with a lot of the CGI, especially in horror movies. And it's not to say that CGI can't be used well, because, like, The Mist that Frank Darabont made, that was a lot of CGI, and that was really good. But if you know that, you know, I just think there's a world of difference between Alex Vincent, the actor, being in the room and being able to touch and interact with the doll than there is between him and a cartoon that isn't tactile, that isn't tangible, that isn't even actually there. I don't know why that should scare me.
Well, I agree. I mean, because what you're talking about is working with green screen. What my preference would be is to work in camera and then have it sweetened by CGI. Which, in other words, you work with a doll that's real and do the best you could, you know, animating it with cables and, you know, on camera. But then you could sweeten the facial expressions with CGI. But it burns so much time, right, that it's probably, it's like, you know, to be honest with you, I still like film better than I like the dream quality, the presence the 35 mil gives you. But it's so expensive compared to shooting digital video.
Right.
So you know that unless you're the biggest director in the world, you can't work film anymore. It's prohibitively expensive. I don't have an answer to that one.
Sure. One more movie I want to talk about, and then I want to talk a little bit about your new project. But a few weeks ago, I DVR'd a movie off of cable called The Temp, because I had never seen it. And I thought, well, sure, it came out in that 90s cycle of, you know, the roommate from hell, the nanny from hell, the secretary from hell, without even realizing that it was one of yours. And then in the opening credits, I see your credit, and I thought, oh, right, that's right, this is Tom Holland. Now, I know that there were some issues with that movie in terms of studio interference and the ending kind of getting botched, and I was wondering maybe if you could talk a little bit about that.
Oh, boy. See, that's the train wreck of my life.
Oh, okay.
I lost control of that film. That film, the ending, that's a studio ending. It should be called a film by Stanley Jaffe, who was in control of the studio at that point, and it had something to do with this is what I was told secondhand. That movie was put into production and given a green light by Brandon Tartikoff, who was the love of who was just a wonderful, wonderful man. Mm-hmm. And I, for some reason, Stanley didn't like anything that Brandon put into production, and The powers that be went after that movie, and I think they went after it not just because the movie got mediocre test scores, and that opened the door up, and they changed the ending, and so the ending is totally incoherent with the movie. And then after I was through, somebody came in and took out all of the horror touches that were in that movie. So that movie does not reflect me at all. I think you see it in some of the acting, but I had any number of visual motifs that echoed, you know, my love of horror, mm-hmm, that are not there in the movie. So, you know, I mean, so I think that they're all my children, you know? I mean, I'm finally responsible for all of them. But that was one of... That was the disappointment, actually,
yeah,
of my career to date. And I mean, it's not that I put down anybody. I mean, you know, it just you know, I remember Joe Farrell. I'm being honest now, and probably nobody will hear this broadcast, so it probably won't make any difference. But I remember Joe Farrell was the man that made to try to quantify in test screenings the audience reaction for, you know, to decide release patterns for Hollywood. The beginning of trying to quantify the unquantifiable came in and said into the room, I was there with all these big high-powered executives, and he said, I know what's wrong with the ending. And there was nothing wrong with the ending, but a couple of reshoots and added shots wouldn't have fixed. But by saying that, it opened the door for the studio imposing their own ending, which totally makes no sense whatsoever. And so the movie lapsed into incoherence. So I think you have a number of good performances in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it just doesn't hold together, and it's flattened visually by taking out the truly scary moments that were there when I had control of the cut.
Well, one of the scenes that I really liked in the movie, and where I felt like the movie was going, and it's maybe in the first half hour or so, when the guy gets his hand caught in the paper shredder, and I thought, oh, this is actually really neat. This is sort of...
I had those moments throughout the movie.
Right. It was a horror movie very much set in a 90s corporate environment.
And they took it out. They took out anything that was scary, anything that was bloody, anything that was psychologically, you know, psychosexual. They took out the whole underbelly of the movie. They disemboweled it. And, you know, it's always they, and who's they? I don't know. I'm sure if you asked everybody, they would say none of them did it, and it was all my fault. Let me tell you, that's not my cut.
So now you're working on something that I think you have pretty much complete control over, right? The project that you're doing for FearNet?
Yes, and I had a wonderful time. It's called Tom Holland's Twisted Tales. It's debuting November 4th. No, they're all coming out at the same time, so you can binge view on FearNet, and it'll be there for, I think, 3 or 4 months before it goes out to Netflix and Hulu. And I had a wonderful experience, and it was because of a man called Peter Block, who runs FearNet. And Peter enticed me by saying, you know, how would you like, you can write whatever you want as long as you think it's terrific and you can direct them and produce them. And I mean, and how could I turn that down? And so I've got 9 shorts that range from the shortest one with AJ Bowen is 8.5 minutes. And the longest one, Pizza Guy, is like 47 or 48 minutes. And that's with
Mark Center.
And Mark Center is the lead on that, and was 4 or 5, you know, young actors who were just terrific. But I mean, I've got a wonderful group of actors in all of them. I've got William Forsythe. I've got Danielle Harris. I've got Ray Wise. I've got Noah Hathaway,
Sarah Butler.
Every one of them has terrific actors. They're all different, and they're all mine. And nobody really messed with them. I think that that there's a wide variety. I mean, I have Shockwave,
Angela Bettis,
James Duval. Amber Benson, and I've got my son, Josh Holland. Every one of them has, it's a terrific group of actors. And I think the shows, you'll like some better than others, but none of them are boring, you know?
Yeah.
None of them, each one of them has interests for in one way or another. And we did them for very, very little money. But the actors make it work. You know, and I had Vince Guastini doing the effects, and Vince did me a real solid by coming in and helping out with very inventive, you know. It looks a hell of a lot better than the money I really had. We were pulling gags off the shelf in Vince's studio that other productions had paid for. and I was writing around what I had. Hmm. And I also have something called Tom Holland's Untold Tales on Kindle, on singles. Because what I did is I took the stories that I didn't have time to make or the money to make, and I wrote them up as short stories in prose. And so if you like the Twisted Tales, please go and look on Kindle at the Untold Tales. Because, I mean, I think they're terrific, too, and I hope that I get a chance to do them. So I had a wonderful experience, you know, with that. And I cannot praise the acting talent in Hollywood enough. I mean, there are just wonderful actors in this town. I mean, they're 10 deep, and there's a whole generation coming up now in digital filmmaking, internet filmmaking, and I worked with them. I mean, probably the average age of my crew was probably around 32 or 33. And there's a lot of up-and-coming talent out there, and what's happened is that digital has crushed the cost of production. So it's you can make things now at a much more affordable price than you could when you were working with 35 mil. I mean, you know, when I got all my life I wanted to make movies, wanted to make film, and I back when I started there wasn't a film school. I went to Northwestern for my first year. They didn't have a film school. I mean, there were no film schools in the country. And they had this little room with a 16mm camera. And, you know, and that's where I started, going out and shooting with myself, acting in it. Because, everybody looked down on making film, you know. It was even day class A then. I'm back in the 60s at Northwestern. And this is, you know, this was a theater school. And we used a cold splicer. And, you know, you used acetone to put the splices together. And you had to wear white gloves, you know. I mean, you know, it was impossibly difficult, labor-intensive, and expensive to get training back in the 60s. And now, you know, you can take your iPhone, for God's sake.
Right.
You know, and everybody's an editor because everybody's got an Apple. And right. Everybody's got, you know, Final Cut Pro. But it's still... I'm saying this to all the young filmmakers, aspiring filmmakers out there. It's still an apprentice business, except now you can go out and do it yourself. You don't have to use 16 or 18 mil. You can do it yourself with digital. And the more you do it, the better you're going to get. And I think that there's a huge amount of talent out there with young cinematographers, editors, actors, certainly. I think we're entering a very exciting period, and although we're still trying to figure out how to monetize it, I think that there's growing opportunity. Here's my prejudice. I think that material is the great problem.
Yeah.
It's people learning how to find or write material that they can transcribe to film, and it's having a narrative sense that's not only visual but is also character based. Because the object of any filmmaking, video making, whatever you want to call it, is to make the audience feel something, and that means that there has to be an honesty that the people on screen are feeling. And there has to be a way that you as an audience member can identify with them and with their problems and the situation that they're in. Mm-hmm. And that means also that it has to have a certain level of credibility in order for you as a viewing member to willingly suspend disbelief. And it's getting those things, which are more ephemeral and much harder to quantify, you know, that's the problem, and the only way you're going to learn how to do that is by doing. So if you're an aspiring filmmaker out there, for God's sakes, go out and shoot as much video as you can. But it's getting a sense of material, narrative drive, and character.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're directing, also actors. Have I pontificated enough or too much?
No, I think that's great. This is the last thing I really want to ask you. As somebody who's been who's seen horror go up and down and through every change you can basically imagine, do you still love the genre as much as you once did?
I love it. Okay, I do. And I'll tell you why. It is infinitely malleable. Horror is a metaphor. It can be a metaphor for whatever's happening in your life, mm-hmm. in society, with your relationships, and it will bear almost any kind of story. It will bear the most serious, most arty movie or artful movie that you want to make, and it can also just be straight ahead gratuitous violence. You know, I mean, it can be the best of Eli Roth. It goes from a very, very light hand of psychological suspense horror, Rosemary's Baby, to, you know, to Tourist. You know, I mean, it can satisfy all of your artistic expectations, and it can also appeal to the most popcorn movie side of you at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always felt it doesn't get the respect that it deserves, but as I see it becoming more and more reliable in terms of a moneymaker for the studio, I think you're going to have more and more talented people attracted to it. So I think, I mean, you see it happening with James Wan now and that stuff that's coming out. You know, I mean, even though I'm getting tired of 100 houses at this point. But I got tired of werewolves too. I mean, I got tired, and I'm tired of vampires. But it constantly reinvents itself. You're going to turn around, and somebody's going to make they're going to make a new Chucky, a new Child's Play. You know, they're going to find out. They're going to find a way to reinvigorate the killer doll movie. You know, somebody will come with a vision that's new and fresh. You know, and that'll take off again. What happens is any of the strands of the genres in horror, somebody comes out with something original, and it kicks off a wave because Hollywood's nothing if not a copycat.
Right.
Because they're always looking for a guarantee of financial return, and eventually it exhausts itself, and then it goes into comedy. Okay, and then out of comedy, it'll go into direct farce. And when it goes into farce, when it's nothing but laughs and silliness, then that signals the exhaustion of that particular genre. And at that point, then it lays quiet for 2 or 3 years. But then somebody who loves killer dolls or who loves vampires like I did with Fright Night will come along, and they'll have a new take on it, and they'll reinvent it, and you'll be into another 20-year run. And I think that horror constantly reinvigorates itself, you know, from when it reaches exhaustion with farce, and it goes off again into something that echoes in the psyche of the audience because it is somehow catching the gestalt or the community experience of that generation. And the people who watch horror, generally speaking, are younger people, and so younger and beginning filmmakers are always attracted to it because it's the most easily financed and the least expensive to do. And so out of all the genres that are out there, except perhaps comedy, out of all the genres that are out there, it is the most vital and alive horror. And thank you all very much. And Patrick, thank you very much for all these terrific, wonderful questions. And Heather, thank you for setting this up and helping me remember names.
Exhausted, can I just tell you? That was so exhausting for me to talk all. I'm just...
Yeah, pipe down over there, will you?
I know, right? I'll keep it down next time.
Thank you guys both so much. This was
I want to thank Brian, her significant other, too, for helping us set up the technical part of this.
Yes, thank you. That is so awesome. Thank all three of you guys so much for...
Thank you, and God bless your audience.
Thank you so much, Mr. Holland.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Boo.
All right, so there you have it. Super awesome, right? Tom Holland rules. If you're like me, you sat through that interview, and now you want to go watch every one of his movies again. So thank you once again to Heather Wixon. Follow her on Twitter, @TheHorrorChick, for setting that up. She was there the whole time. She just decided to sort of be quiet and let me talk to Tom Holland, which was super nice, but you heard her chime in at the end there and every once in a while. She's going to be back on the show in October, and actually, if you guys have suggestions for topics that you want to hear me and Heather do for an October show, go ahead and leave them in the comments or tweet us at @FThisMovie. Thanks to Brian Smith for being there and setting up all the equipment and making sure that Tom Holland sounded good and for hanging out during the interview. And, of course, thanks most of all to Tom Holland for entertaining my questions for an hour and just being a really great guy to talk to and for all of his movies. I mean, his movies have meant a lot to me since I was a kid in the 80s. So it was, you know, this was one of the highlights of F This Movie for me since starting it a couple of years ago. This was one of the coolest things I've gotten to do. So, and make sure you guys check out Tom Holland's Twisted Tales when it premieres on FearNet in November. I will be back next week, hopefully not as congested, but happy Scary Movie Month, everyone. See you in October.